My name is Bob Darrell, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Bob.
A couple guys had asked me over the break to kind of go over point by point the six things and resentments, the six things and fears, and the 12 things and sex that the book asks us to do. If you bear with me, on page 65, we have the first three things. We call them one, that we make a list of who. Also, the person, the principal or institution. Column two, what was affected, hurt, threatened, injured, or interfered with. Column three, what was affected. No, that's right. No, yeah, what was affected, hurt, injured, interfered. Column one is who. Column two is the cause. What was affected. What was hurt, column three, was affected, manifestations of self. And then number four is on the bottom of page 66, is a realization. The book doesn't say to write. It says we must realize something. It's an other-centered realization that is very, very critical, that we realize how the person who had harmed us was perhaps like us, spiritually sick. A very other-centered and important realization. That's the fourth thing. The fifth thing is the prayer. And it's an unusual prayer because it's a call for action. Because I'm asking God to help me to take some actions. To help me to show this person I resent the same patience, pity, and tolerance I would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When I'm asking God to help me to show someone, I'm asking Him to help me to demonstrate or act towards them. And there's a beauty in prayer in and of itself is very good, but when prayer is met with constructive action, it's powerful. In other words, if I'm going to ask God to do something, I have to show up and act as if He's going to do it. There's an old adage, without Him I can't, but without me He won't. Right? It's like I'm going to ask God, if you want to ask God to get you a job, you ought to start looking in the classifieds as if He's got one in there for you. Right? You got to start acting like He's going to do what He asked you to do. And so I'm going to ask Him to help me to show them, saying patience, pity, and tolerance, I would cheerfully grant a sick friend. And then finally, this is one of the most, I think, misinterpreted parts. In the center of page 67, it says something twice in the same paragraph. There's certain questions in the middle of the paragraph, and the questions are bracketed by a point that is reiterated coming into the questions and reiterated coming out of the questions because it's so important. It starts off by saying, putting out of our minds the wrongs others have done. We resolutely look for our own mistakes. And then the questions, where in each of these cases was I, looking for my own mistakes, was I selfish with this person that I judged so harshly? Where was I dishonest? Where was I self-seeking? Where was I frightened, etc., etc.? And then it says it again. We tried to disregard the other person involved entirely. I caught myself saying something in AA 20-some years ago, and I don't know, it was when I caught it, I guess, and I was... And it was something that a lot of us say when we refer to this part of the inventory process, and I would say this is where we look for our part. The book doesn't say that. Matter of fact, if you take the implication, if we disregard the other person involved entirely, we're not even looking in the parts business. Because if I'm going to look for my part, okay, I got my part. Says on here, their part. Whose part do you think is bigger? Right? And by looking for my part, I am unconsciously reserving the right that they had a part. And here's how this came to me. So this guy, I sent this guy out. We just finished his 8-step list, and he went out to make amends to this one guy, and came back, and he was pissed, and it didn't go well. And what did he do? He went to clear up his part, and then stood there like, and started getting aggravated because the guy didn't clear up his part. He didn't do what it said in the book. He did not disregard the other person involved entirely. He did not put out of his mind the wrongs the other person had done. He still held on to the fact that they had a part in this. An ego does not want to let go of that goodie. It does not. It loves feeling other people are wrong. But the book says we disregard them entirely. And we look for our own mistakes. And I think that's when you do this with our course, is where the consciousness changes. And then you know what the big realization is for some of us? That the exact nature of our wrongs is how much I miss taking from that experience of that person. I never got it. I never got that you were afraid. I never got that you were hurt, that you were just like me, driven by some of the stuff that drove me. Because I was too self-centered to ever get you. I got too much of me between me and you. And then fears. The 6 things in fears. The first thing, we reviewed our fears thoroughly. So I'm a list guy. I think we make a list of fears. The second thing, after we put them on paper, the second thing is we ask ourselves why we had them. Now, I think this is a very, very important question. Because if you look at the section on step 8, it says that we already have our 8-step list. We made it when we took inventory. So, in a sense, we are not only doing our 4th step, we are building an 8-step list. Right? And this question will unlock in fears unfinished business, things that have to be mended. Now remember, amends is not always saying you're sorry. Amends is often tears in the continuity of my life. Amends is often things that just have to be fixed, addressed, mended, walked through, faced, paid back. Why do you have the fear? Why do you get anxious when any time people mention the IRS? Could it be because you've cheated on your taxes? Why every time somebody brings up Charlie Parker's name, I get a knot in the pit of my stomach? Why is that? Why do I get that anxiety when I go walk into a meeting and Charlie's there and I go, be here? Well, maybe because I've been talking crap behind Charlie's back and I'm afraid some of it got back to him, right? Why do you have the fear? Inevitably, it will uncover an event. And oddly enough, isn't it, you don't get free of the fears just like you don't get free of the resentment until you make the amends. All the self-knowledge doesn't help. Isn't it odd how you can have resentments you can have for 5 and 10 years? And you will never get free of it because you're still right about that person. And me make amends to him. Well, look what he did to me, for God's sakes. I don't owe him an amends. But who and where is the source of the conflict and the separation and the judgment? It is in me. I must mend this separation between me and that person. The amends is the only freedom I'm ever going to get. I just was with a guy sober almost 20 years, and he did the second 5th step with me in a year. And I'm not even 5 minutes into this resentment. I said, that's the same resentment you had when you did the last one. He said, well, I still have it. And I said to him, did you make the amends? He said, not yet. I said, well, of course you still have them. But some of these, I don't really owe them amends. If you're in conflict, something has to be mended here. Right? Well, what if they really owe me an amends? Well, maybe they don't have the tools to do that. So your choice is, you want to sit and feel like you feel, or you want to be free. Amends have to be made. Separation can't. We can't see. It's only the ego that's in the right wrong business. The ego judges. The ego's in the right wrong business. The spirit is simply in the connected love business. The spirit doesn't judge. The spirit longs for unity. It's the ego that creates the separation. And oh man, my ego likes to be right. Oh jeez. So what do we do? Reviewed our fears thoroughly. One, listed them. Two, ask ourselves why we had them. Three, the question. There's a question. Because you know it's a question because it ends with a question mark. Wasn't it because self-reliance failed me? Was that true? I heard a guy years ago say, I've never had a problem that's hurt me as much as my solutions to my problems. We often will make our fears come true based on self-reliance. My efforts to protect myself from the fear almost magnetizes the fear and makes it come true and brings it to me. How many times do we lose jobs because we go to work and we got this anxiety about not fitting there and not being accepted, and we might eventually lose this job, and what happens? We lose the job. It's like self-fulfilling prophecies. I'm in a relationship, I'm afraid she's going to dump me. So what happens? I become so possessive and so controlling that I eventually push her out of my life, and then the fear comes true. Right? Was it because self-reliance failed me? Self-reliance was good as far as it went, but didn't go far enough. Some of us once had great self-confidence. Those were in the days where we were barely tolerable. But it didn't fully solve the fear problem. It really didn't. This is a dog you cannot feed with willfulness. Didn't fully solve the fear problem or any other. When it made us cocky, number four, it was worse. It wasn't. Is that true? I'll tell you, it was for me. You know, I all my life I've responded to fear one of two ways. Either as a turtle, and I will pull my head into my shell and just kind of withdraw and wait for it to go away. And then at other times I'd respond to fear like a skunk and spray everybody around me. And I think of the two positions, it's a little better being a turtle than a skunk, because turtles make less amends. But neither one is really optimum. The book says perhaps there's a better way. We think so. For now, on a different basis. What's the basis? Remember step three? The foundation of our life is based in a decision. In the 12 steps and 12 traditions, it says that the effectiveness of the whole AA program will rest on this basis, this decision. On a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God, the fifth thing it says to do is we trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. I have to get it that I don't have this managing my fears is such a futile proposition because I don't have the power. If there is one who has all power, that means there ain't no power here. It's an illusion. It's an illusion. How do we keep that illusion going? Well, because once in a while, through self-will, it kind of works out. But a broken clock's right twice a day, that doesn't mean it tells time. So I'll take the one. We did the same thing with our drinking. The one time you went out and you had fun and you didn't go to jail, it was really good. And you'll look at that one time and then try to duplicate that through jail. I mean, you'll burn your life to the ground chasing something like that. And I did the same thing with self-will. I'll look at the one or two times that I pushed on life and actually rested something and it worked out. As if I can do that. I can't. There's one who has all power. I don't have any power. So we trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We're in the world to play the role He assigns. I'm in the business now, the basis of surrendering my opinion, my judgment, my very will, and consequently my life. And then what the very last thing it says, we ask, at the bottom of this paragraph, we ask God to remove our fear and direct our attention to what He would have us be. Not what He would have us do, but what He would have us be. I think by this time, and I really encourage the guys I work with to try to get a vision of what does a guy look like that's carrying out the decision in step 3. The decision of self-abandonment and service. What does a guy like that look like? And then try to move towards that vision of what that guy looks like. What God, what you starting to get in your heart, a sense of the guy that God would have you be. So I ask God to remove the fear and to direct my attention to what He would have me be. See, didn't I give Him my life for Him to build with me and Him to do with me? So I'm not looking for my vision of my life and what I would have me be. I'm trying to line my will and my vision up with His vision. It's what He would have me be. And I think that when it says in our literature that that's the proper use of the will, aligning mine with God's, it becomes very apparent to some of us that for God's sakes, look where the vision of my life has led me. It's led me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, this is beyond Amway. This is bad. Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, oh my God. Like Joe McQueenie said something one time, I thought it was hilarious. He said, he ended up in AA. He said, he felt like he joined the Salvation Army band. Oh, yeah. Alcoholics Anonymous. My vision of my will. My life. That's where... So, the reality is that any vision of my life other than mine is probably going to be better. If you, when you were in high school, would have hired the most brilliant board from the biggest universities of sociologists and psychologists that you could have hired, and you would have given them the task, over the next few years, give me a game plan that's going to ultimately result in me hating myself, thinking about killing myself, being totally alone, with nothing left inside me or outside me of any value, that where I'm just suicidal and depressed. Could you come up with a game plan that would end up like that in a few years? They couldn't have come up with anything more effective than what you've created in your life over the following years or preceding coming to AA. And yet we judge ourselves and our intentions. Well, I didn't really intend that to be that way. But we were the source, even though we didn't see it. We didn't see it. And then it says the 12 things. It can be argued that it's 9 things, 9 questions that can be, but I believe 3 of them could be answered twice. So it would actually be 12. That's a matter of opinion. But there's actually 9 questions. And they start on the middle of page 69, which if I ever die and get to meet Bill Wilson, I gotta ask him, did you plan on for the sex inventory being on page 69, or was God showing off? I mean, what's that about? I mean, it's, I think sometimes God just gets out the bozo the clown nose and just thinks he's funny. You know, I don't know. Anyway, in the middle of page 69, it says, we reviewed our conduct over the years past. Question number 1, in all these relationships, this list of relationships, where had I been selfish? Where had I been dishonest? Where had I been inconsiderate? Whom had I hurt? Number four. Did I unjustifiably arouse jealousy in myself or in my partner? That could be two questions. I think we can do it both ways. You can unjustifiably arouse jealousy in yourself by just obsessing on what they're doing until it makes you a crazy person, until you're driving by their apartment in the middle of the night to see if anybody's car is there, until you're nuts. Mm-hmm. Or you can unjustifiably arouse it in your partner by flirting with, well, you're not getting enough attention, so you flirt with people of the opposite sex where they can see you to bring their attention undividedly back to you. It's a type of manipulation. Did I unjustifiably arouse suspicion in myself or in my partner, which would be either question six or eight, I suppose. Did I unjustifiably arouse bitterness in myself or in my partner? Where was I at fault? And what to me is the premier question, the one I'm going to build my life on. What should I have done instead? I'll tell you why that's the premier question. It's later on in this process I'm going to ask God for something. I'm going to ask Him to mold my ideals and to give me a vision for my future sex life. And I tell you what my experience is, you will build it on the things that you should have did different. See, I'm one of those kind of guys that lives, I live in a universe that is very, very kind and very, very merciful. It's a universe of do-overs. You screwed it up in your first marriage, you're going to get a do-over, I'm telling you. You're going to, all the things that you can look back and you, man, I wish I wouldn't have been that way, I wish I wouldn't have done that, and I should have done this instead. If you know what you should have done instead, when the do-over comes around, you've got a vision. You have an ideal of what to be in that situation. And if you're like me, and you don't have that, and you don't bring some grace into your life at that point, it's just natural to revert back to the way I was before. It's like, it's instinctive. It's a default position. That's why, how often we do, Katie was talking about, you go through your sexual relationships and you see these patterns. Oh my God, I did the same thing in that relationship. I did the same thing, and the same thing, and the same thing. Or you do alternating things. It's like, I was the rejector, and then the rejectee, and then the rejector, and then the rejectee. I hurt her. That girl hurt me. I hurt this one. She hurt me. And there's patterns in there, right? Because we never get it. We never get free of it until we do this process. Until I get a vision of what I could have done instead, and then I'm bringing God into it to mold my future sex life, and mold my ideals. We got this all down on paper and looked at it. In this way, we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. I remember the first time I ever read that. And I thinking about God's going to create a sane and sound ideal for my future sex life. I get this sinking feeling like, I don't think God's idea of sex, a sane and God's idea of sex and my idea of sex, I think His idea is going to be really hard and tedious and boring. And to my surprise, what reality is my way of doing things is awful and is painful and is tedious and it brings more loneliness and more desolation. And you kind of get that. Then anything that God has to offer, you start getting it. It's going to be better than what I've been getting. Right? It's going to be better than what I've been getting. So whatever our ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow towards it. We must be willing to make amends where we've done harm. One of my favorite lines in the book, it says, we treat sex as we would any other problem. When you're new and you're obsessed with it, and you have this emptiness and this vacancy, and you're secretly suspected that you need a relationship to be whole, it doesn't look like it's any other problem. But it really is. the same problems that defeat me in a job, the same things that will defeat me in relationships, the same thing that puts me at odds with you and AA and the people in my family and the people out in the world, underneath it all, the exact nature is the same in relationships as it is in work and every other area of my life. It's manifestations of self. That's why, you know, oddly enough, I mean, men ideally sponsor men and women sponsor women. But ideally, a woman could hear a guy's sex inventory and a man could hear a woman's because there's nothing in it about sex. There's not one question in here that actually has to do with sex. It has to do with selfishness, dishonesty, fear. To my amazement, there was nothing in here about sex. I thought before I ever read the book, I thought the sex inventory would be like the Kama Sutra with a spiritual twinge or something. You know, I mean, but it's not like that at all. It's not even about sex. It's about self. Remember when we started this process, the book says we're going to look for the manifestations of self which had defeated us. And that, does everybody see the parts? Okay, and that brings us up to step 5. I'm not going to talk anything about step 5. Maybe Katie might have. Do you want to do a little bit on 5? Do you want us to just...
Yeah, I actually do. How about you? You just did about almost 30 minutes. How about if I do 10 on 5?
Okay.
Is that okay?
If you want to do a little on 6 and 7, then I'll jump in and do a little on 6 and 7.
Perfect. Okay, then we'll go for that. The I just love working with Bob. I love working with Charlie too, honey. When we do these, I love that. I love you.
If you don't mention Charlie's name at least once in a while.
I know, I'm in trouble. He does. I know it. But, yeah, you almost feel like you're cheating on somebody. Not that I know how that feels. Page 74. Very, very important line. Once again, you know, and especially for you guys that have been sober, you know, 20 plus years. We got sober in a time when codependency, family of origin, and our feelings were very important. And all of a sudden now, you know, somebody steps aside and says, your feelings are not important. Very strong misunderstanding about that. We're talking about the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've had so much inner child work, and I'm not knocking it. But I'm telling you, you can figure out how to manifest self and protect it behind family of origin stuff. And it can be very dangerous. That was my experience. Page 74, first paragraph down, the last line in it. The rule is we must be hard on ourselves, but always considerate of others. Does this not almost go against every fiber in your being? You have to nod your head on that one. Yes? I mean, isn't that amazing? It's like, and considerate of others. Oh, it's like taking, you know, castor oil or something. You're like, whoa! And the truth is with this concept, it's exactly what Bob says. The paradox of the whole deal is the ninth step. The forgiveness is the magic key. And I don't want to jump ahead too far with that one, but I also want to say, page 67, I know it looks like we're backtracking, but we're not. It says, we cannot be helpful to all people, but we ask God, but at least God will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one. That line has given me a little bit of an out in the fact that I really, you kind of bugged me, if you really want to know the truth. And I got to be careful to watch out for spiritual pride and sainthoodism, right? And so that line, my sponsors pointed that out since I have such a problem with self-righteous and spiritual pride. She said, Katie, it shows you right there that God's given us a little bit of a tweak that doesn't mean we got to have everybody over for Thanksgiving dinner. even people we don't like. But it's saying that we can ask God, at least ask God to show us to take a kindly and tolerant view. Because left on my own, I'll snub you. And I kind of like that. And then the one other one is it says, when it's talking about the fear at the very bottom of that page on 67, it set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune. We felt we didn't deserve, but did we not ourselves see where we set the ball rolling? Oh my gosh. That's where we're always looking for, is where do we set the ball rolling? Well, I think one of the most powerful things I've learned in the time of sobriety I've had and working with, and the pleasure of working with so many sponsees, is doing, Bob once said it at one big book study we were at, he said, I like to keep my finger on the pulse. And in doing so, that means I have to work with the new guy. I keep a new guy usually close by. And I sponsor a lot of people, and I'm not saying you have to sponsor a lot of people. I will point out where the book says you should sponsor a lot of people, but I won't tell you you have to, okay? As long as I can put it to the book, we'll let the book take the heat. But I was finding that I wasn't always getting the new guy, because the new guy is a lot of work. A lot of work. And I didn't want to have to do that. And they got to get through the steps pretty quickly, and they're relying on me. I mean, sometimes they don't even know what color socks to pick out. You know what I mean? I'm like, so when I sit down with them and do this inventory, and I've been given this incredible gift of having people trust that God will work through me, I found that the third column in a four-column inventory, it's radically changed the way I see the third column. And it is, I always wrote, just as the book has it, you know, the self-esteem, ambition, pride, blah, 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 right? Y'all with me? It affects mine. But I never really understood what those words meant. Now, some of you guys might, but I didn't. I just, yeah, it affects my self-esteem. I mean, I don't feel very good. That's about all I thought. It affects my pride. Well, they love me. That's about all I gave it. Well, I started looking at this, and somebody said, well, what if you say how it affects your self-esteem, like, I'm the best wife he's ever had. I am a great mother to that child. And you know, that's how they affected my self-esteem, because they went against it. My pride is the way others see me. My ambition is what I want. My security is what I need. My personal relationships are my deep-seated beliefs in that. Men should be. Women are. Children should respect their parents. Right? And when I started getting down to that, well, what did I find? I found my old ideas. Oh my gosh. I don't know their old ideas till they gotta show up somewhere so that I've got something in 6 and 7. I got something in that hour of 5 and something to take to God in 6 and 7. I am blown away at that third column. It's like, oh my gosh. That's what's driving me. I mean, you really want to sit down with a group of women and ask them if a goddamn Dove commercial could get any more half-naked beautiful woman on a soap commercial. Right? Maybe a lot of you guys are digging it.
I miss all the good ones.
But, you know, we're raising girls. We're trying to keep this image about ourselves. So we've got to be. And then you're watching TV and, you know, they're selling the cell phone right next to the cleavage. Right? We're inundated with so much of this stuff that makes it very, very difficult. And so what we say is, this is what you want me to live up to. You know, you guys are hit with the fact you gotta have money. You gotta have money. If you wanna be somebody, you better have money. And the women are after the money. Right? I mean, we got all these old ideas. Boys only want sex. Girls are slutty if they give it away. And we don't even know we've got them. And yet, I love what Bob says, because he always says, when I can see me in you, I can forgive you. When I can see that I can be as trashy as anybody else, as shallow as anybody else, as hypocritical as anybody else, I can forgive you. When driven by that fear that we're talking about, I could behave just like you given the same circumstance. And I can get to compassion like that. That's the part where all the promises of the book, they tell me I'll be placed in a position of neutrality. I'll be able to match calamity with serenity. We were talking at lunch about this level of humility. I don't have those by nature. Those are all promises. I must do all this work in order to be placed in a position of neutrality. I love the line that says, pause when agitated. If you're not working much of a program, that's a crapshoot. No pausing today. Right? But, that you know, and it does say agitated and doubtful. So you're sitting with this person, and you're getting down to these, you know, you get them in that level of seeing their old beliefs, and you move them into this spot of seeing a hypocrite. Seeing a level of entitlement. Who's the first person on your inventory? It's always mom and dad. It's always mom and dad. And then you are a parent yourself, and if your child was sitting in the room, who'd be their first person on their inventory? You. And it would it look almost exactly like your inventory to your parents? Yeah, absolutely. Because we're hypocrites. You know, dad was a drunk. So are you. Okay? And, you know, they just, whoa, we're entirely, look at it with entirely differently. And see, one of the other things that I think is so important in where were we dishonest? Dishonest is three tiers to me. You know, selfish, absolutely. Dishonest, most people think it's just flat out lying. Absolutely, it is flat out lying. And I am capable of lobbing a lie right out there. How many of y'all have long-term sobriety and you just lie? It's unbelievable, isn't it? Well, I know, I called him yesterday. No, I didn't. Call him yesterday. Why did I even say that? Ooh. Just lobbed it right out there. And then I can't even hear what they're saying because I'm thinking, I just lied. Oh my God, I just lied right there. Flat out lying. I call it sin by omission, which sounds too Christian to some people, but it's not telling the full truth. It's telling a portion of the truth, right? You're late for work. You're on your way to work. There's an accident on the side of the road, and you go, yes! And you get to work, and you go, oh, there was a wreck on 6th Street. Did anybody see it? It's terrible. But the truth is you were late for work because you left late, right? Level of dishonesty. And then believing the delusional lie. And that one is what drives most all of us. Is fancied or real, it's the delusion that if you actually sat down your family, have you ever sat and had a conversation with a sibling and you both were in the same house and it's like you were raised in two different families, the way they saw it and the way you saw it. It's unbelievable, isn't it? And so that's that level of delusion. And so when we break down this fourth column that I just so desperately love, selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, that's what Bob said, self-manifested in various ways, manipulating, controlling, all of that. How did we do this? How do we manipulate? How do we do all this self-seeking? And then, of course, frightened. And it says the inventory was ours, right? When we saw our faults, we listed them, we placed them before us in black and white. We admitted our wrongs honestly and were willing to set these matters straight. And that's the key, guys, is what I see happens is if you really want to get knee-deep actively involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, start asking a lot of questions to people. So what steps were you working on when you decided to drink? How far had you gone through the steps? What were you doing? Instead of, you know, a lot of people always say, were you going to meetings? I don't care if you were going to meetings or not. I want to know where you were in the steps. The drink preceded the steps, the meetings long before. You know, well, they quit going to meetings. That's what you always hear people say. They quit going to meetings. Well, when did they quit working the steps? Because that is what I want to know. So I want to have some ammo back at this person to begin to open their eyes to what happened. And the majority of people, I don't know if this is true for you, Bob, but they stop at the fifth step. They get that relief. Because listen to the fifth step promises. They're fabulous. It says, on page 75, second paragraph down. We pocketed our pride. Oh, let me tell you, remember my sponsor and her head bobbing thing? Right? I wasn't talking. I was like, you are bugging me, chick. I'm going to take you out right now. And we go illuminating every twist of character. Wow. Every dark cranny of our past. Once we have taken this step, withholding nothing, it's very important to ask for that one dark, deep, dark secret. I know that Bob, you're as twisted as I am. When you ask him that question, you're like this. Okay, come on. Is there anything you're withholding and you're just dying for it? It's like, and they usually don't really lob out much of anything. You know what I mean? They'll go, well, there was one time, and I'm all ready for some juicy story. And it's not. But it says, we are delighted. Now, let me tell you. When you do a fifth step, if you are not delighted, I think it's your job as a sponsor. Flip back over to this page. It says, page 64, to get rid of them promptly and without regret. So if you are not delighted, you're hanging on to some sort of self-pity, right? All of a sudden, you're not happy about that. So page 64, middle of the page, where it says, to get rid of them promptly and without regret. Is everybody following me on that one? Very important. We can look the world in the eye. That right there is telling you that shame, that humiliation. You're beginning to get a little glimpse of what that feels like. Now, trust me, you really don't get the whole shebang until you've followed it through to the ninth step about that shame and ease, or shame and discomfort. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. There's that peace of mind. Isn't that really what we all want? This thing to shut up? There was a couple of days ago I was doing my quiet time and I just was overwhelmed with tears. And I said, I never in my wildest dreams, God, thought you and I could be this tight. And it was just, I was so clear that I'll be taken care of. No matter what. No matter if I lose my children, lose my husband, lose my job, lose my life. I was that's a pretty cool place to be, guys. And if you've never experienced it, just stick with us. Our fears fall from us. That sounds pretty cool too, doesn't it? That's what I'm talking about. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. This is what Bob was saying. This is when the magic's happening because we're starting to pull down from that flashlight. We're starting to get that sunlight of that Spirit. Let me tell you don't even have any idea how quick it can go. There it is again, right? It just covers right back up, man. If this left unattended, this work, you will cover that flashlight up so quick. Talks about having had spiritual beliefs, now we're having a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. We're on that broad highway. So it says returning home. Now, a lot of people think that the fifth step ends when you leave your sponsor. The book is clear on that the fifth step does not end. You take 1 hour when you return home. So I don't always say that you go do 6 and 7. 6 and 7 in my eyes are a part of this. But it tells me very clearly, returning home we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour. So I'm still not even done with the fifth step. That 1 hour is where the real magic takes place for me. And this is once again our buddy Mark. Absolutely blew me away when he explained what that hour looks like. I remember my jaw dropping. And he said, you carefully read the first 5 proposals. We ask if we've omitted anything. And he just goes down the list. Do I really believe I've got an allergy? Do I have a mental obsession that's coupled by a malady and blah, 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 blah? Do I really believe that this God of my understanding? In the third step, am I really willing to bring to God everything that I see in self that I absolutely cannot manage? Am I willing in this fourth step? And I mean, it was just like, whoa, I didn't realize. But then if you think about it, you've got a whole hour, right? I mean, how many of you guys, if you found that hour was like you couldn't find the time, you got to go over those 5 steps. You got to relook at everything. Hell, just reread everything that's been highlighted in your book. That'll take some time, right? Those areas. And then it gives you all the questions. Is our work solid so far? if you're making, you're building a home. It's on a concrete slab, right? You would never put a home on sand. So you put it on this concrete slab, this foundation you're building. Are the stones in place? Have we skimped on anything? Because that house, in about 15 years, if it starts to, the foundation cracks, it's not good. And let me tell you, at 17 years sober, my foundation was challenged. I'm sitting there, I am so far into untreated alcoholism, it's just a matter of time that I'm going to drink. Period. Matter of time. If I drank, it would not have shocked anybody in the community. I was clearly an untreated alcoholic. We call it dry. I think that's too light of a word. I think we need to call the disease as the disease is, untreated alcoholism. I'm at this huge event in Austin called Austin City Limits. And I mean, it is big and there's a band. But right where they put it is a cellular hole. Have you ever been in those where you're driving on your phone and you know your phone drops out? The cellular hole. Well, the goddamn festival's in a cellular hole. And it's kind of funny because you watch people walk around and go, can you hear me now? 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 Nobody's cell phone's working. It's just a weird deal. And so, and I am crazy. Charlie and I are dating. My husband's gone. I'm dressing like I did when I hung out in the bars. I got everything going on but the drink. Are you with me on that? I'm walking around this place. My son's out doing something. He's a teenager. And I'm walking around there and I am, so the melody is all over me. And U2 or Rotten Potatoes or somebody was playing. And one of the guys comes and sees me and says, hey, we're going to have a party backstage. Would you like to come to it? Girls, are you with me? I still got it going on. That's good. Right? I'm all about me. Now, keep in mind, self is all over me. I'm in my late 40s, and the band still wants me to come backstage. And the next thing you know, I'm having a moment of, I'm losing my mind. And it felt like the world was, have you ever seen in movies where they have everybody moving around the person and they're completely still? You know how they do that in Hollywood? And it literally felt that way. And I just went, forget it. There was a huge Heineken bottle blown up. I hated Heineken. But I thought, I'm going to have a drink. I'm done. As a matter of fact, I remember thinking, I'm checking out. I'm going to drink a little and then I'm going to take about 150 pills. I'm out of here. I'm done with this deal. So I'm walking only about 50 feet. And my phone rings. It's a cellular hole. Your phone, nothing's working. Hello, hello, hello. Well, it's someone I had met. They had a couple of years sober and they said, what are you doing? Now the miracle was God sent me one more life raft. That was the miracle, the phone call. The foundation of Alcoholics Anonymous was that one moment that I better tell the truth. I could have said, fine, I'm doing laundry. I said, I was. As a matter of fact, I'm getting ready to get a beer. See, that's the foundation I'm talking about. You got one chance there to see if your house is on solid ground. And I was raised on solid ground in Alcoholics Anonymous. Isn't that unbelievable when you see it that way? Because some people say it was a miracle that I didn't drink. Oh, I see. You drank because you didn't have a miracle left. Thank God I had a miracle still left. See, I believe the phone call was the miracle. The foundation of Alcoholics Anonymous, the moment of clarity, was me doing that right there. Because I was raised on Alcoholics Anonymous. I was raised on it. I had a hell of a foundation. It didn't even waver. It was like, I'm getting ready to have a beer. No, I just blew that one. But needless to say, then my life took an incredible course. Incredible. And I'm here today. I'm here today. Had I not gotten that phone call, I guarantee I'd be dead. I would die. I got way too much pride. I'm not coming back in here. I'm dying. Joe's dead. Sorry, kids. Could we both be any more self-centered? The disease of alcoholism took us both out. My children are young. Isn't that just terrible? That's what this disease will do. I'm not going to be thinking of my kids. They're grown, for God's sakes. Is that terrible? They're grown, so that means that they, since they don't need me, since they're not 7 and 8, could you imagine a 30 and 20 year old? Mom and Dad both died of alcoholism and had 20 plus years in Alcoholics Anonymous? Pretty devastating. So, 6 and 7. I do 6 and 7 fairly quickly. I say the hour is in the fifth step. So I say, okay, so we turn to page 76. If we can answer to our satisfaction, well, that's what it's asking you. Can you say your house is going to be on solid ground? Or have you been dishonest? Or did you do a weak program? Or have you been pretty lame in that inventory process? All right? Did you really walk away resentful still? Well, I answered yes to it, right? I call it pulling back the curtain, and y'all hear my sponsees go, the curtain was pulled back, Katie. It's just like God goes, okay, you asked. Are you ready for the truth? Because there it is. See, what we get, when we ask God for patience, we don't get, God doesn't give us situations. I absolutely can't stand to hear in AA when people say, be careful what you pray for. That's like a God that throws arrows at you. You know, watch out what you pray for. And God's out there going, you want that? Like a little rat in a box, you know? That's not my loving God. You ask God, God, help me with patience today. He says, okay, well, it's been all around you. I'm just going to give you heightened awareness. Here it is. Now you see it. If I told you to go out there and look at how many white cars are there, as a matter of fact, do that today. See how many white vehicles are out there. It's about every other car is a white vehicle. Now you may not even be aware of that. But now that you have heightened awareness, it's everywhere. It's always been around you. You're just open to it now. See, that's what God does. He says, you really want this? Pull back that curtain. And that's what that inventory process is about. Put your seatbelt on. We're going to rocket you into a fourth dimension. So it says, we've emphasized willingness as being indispensable. What in your life is indispensable? Air, water, shelter, and food. Wouldn't you say that? Yeah. So you're going to tell me that willingness is that important? You bet it is. Because when God gave us self-will, He said, with self-will, you have to be willing or I can't help you. I am capable of shooting another individual. Would you agree? Are you okay? If I gave you a gun and said, man, it's shoot one person. Woo. You're capable of actually shooting somebody, right? God says, ooh, that's not good. But you could do it. See, because you've been given free will, you can do whatever you want to do. But the key is that we're bringing God's will up. So it says, willingness is indispensable. It is the key that opens the door. Are you now ready to let God remove from us all, you might want to underline the word all, the things which we have admitted are objectionable? Well, we saw a lot of things about ourselves that are objectionable, didn't we? A lot of character defects. This is not who you are, it's how you behave. Can He now take them all, every one? Now that's a good question. I don't know about you, but I have not surrendered all my defects to God. I still am full of way too much pride. Way too much pride. Still struggle. If we still cling to something we will not let go of, we ask God to help us be willing. Once again, that word willingness is so powerful. Sometimes even just to be willing, right? It says, when ready, we ask something like this, my Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, the good and the bad. I never understood the word good and bad. I thought, my God, I don't have much, but don't take the last of my good. I mean, I'm holding on to just everything I got. But the truth of the matter is when it says I can't even trust my motives, even when trying to be kind, the way I understand that means that I am giving to God the good and the bad of me and saying, I don't even know what's good and what's bad. I'm so delusional here. I don't even know how to use it. He said, we'll get you into that reborn stage, right? That's what the book was saying. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellow. That is incredible. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. It says, we have then completed step 7, the surrender step. Now guys, did you see anywhere in there where you get to coast? Absolutely not. People say, well, I'm on step six. What does that mean? What does being on a step even mean? What are you standing on? You know? And so, when we bring them to the book, we show them there's I mean, I'll even say, if somebody says, well, I'm on step six, I'll go, well, what does your sponsor say about that? And I ask them some questions, and then I find out who their sponsor is. Sometimes we'll talk. Because, you know, I really take it as my personal responsibility to help people who were sitting there. If you asked me to sponsor you in untreated alcoholism when I was in untreated alcoholism, what do you think I was giving you? We could call it the best I had. But that darn sure wasn't good. And I'll talk to the sponsor. I'll help the sponsor. Charlie and I are very active in our AA community, and a lot of people are very open to this. I have a meeting at our house where I teach women how to sponsor once a month on a Monday night. I have over 50 women so that I can knock that nonsense statement that there are not enough strong AA women. Hate that statement. It's like, who's making that? Absolutely. And then yet, Bob is doing a thing with me, and how many of y'all had a problem with that? I just sit on that old idea for a minute. Where's the guy that he was supposed to bring? We don't have enough strong women. We've all gone round and round about this. We can say there are not enough strong sponsors in Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't get to pick a gender. Thank you very much. Bob, it's your turn. You're welcome.
I'm Bob Darrell, an alcoholic. I can just picture my name materializing on her resentment. I'm amazed over the years how many guys I've worked with double-digit sobriety will get in a lot of trouble within themselves, and how often it's a problem of step six and seven. I had a guy not too long ago came up to my house, and a guy that I'd sponsored, and he was in a lot of trouble, and he wants to do an in-depth 10th step, and he thinks that the problem is in step 10. And after I listened to him for a little bit, I told him, I said, no, the problem isn't in step 10, the problem is in step 6. And he said, oh, I did step 6. And he did. He did the academics and the mechanics of it on page 76. But remember when we started this process in chapter 3, it says, where it said we had to fully concede to our innermost self. I think that often in the realm of the spirit, there's a backwash. You take the actions over here on a certain step, and then all of a sudden things line up later, and then the inside job gets to happen. And what had happened is he went through the motions of the two prayers, the hour between the five and when you do the six and seven, and the willingness prayer, and then the prayer of in the seventh step. But he wasn't really entirely ready at that point. And I don't think that's unusual. I know with myself, I'm very, my spiritual pride and my pathetic need to look good in AA has often driven me to try to imagine and fancy I'm something I'm not. That I have been in, oh, I'm really ready to let go of that. Even I know I look like I'm still doing it, but I'm not really. And how do you become entirely ready? I think for me it's the same dynamic as with drinking. My defects of character are manifestations of self that I have used to defend myself. They're almost like defective defense mechanisms that I've used to defend myself against a world that is very frightening to a self-centered person. a world that looks very vacant to a self-centered person. They're mechanisms designed to validate me, to gratify me, to protect me, to shore me up, to secure me. And the reality is that they're defective. And I think it takes a while in sobriety, functioning on these manifestations of self before we start to hit the wall with some of this stuff. Because the intellectual acknowledgement that they're objectionable, which you can see very clearly in a fourth and fifth step, does not necessarily, now it may in some people lend itself to the innermost self and becoming entirely ready, but often for some of us it's just an intellectual recognition. There's a difference. And then 5, 6, 8 years later, I'm hitting the bottom with some of this stuff. I think one of the things that happens to some of us is, and you know how you start to get free of these things? You can always tell someone who's free because they will joke about those defects and they'll laugh about them. In step 7, it says we humbly. It's in the whole chapter in the 12 and 12 has to do with humility on step 7. Do you know that humility comes from a root word, humus, which means earth, down to earth? It's the same root word as the word humor. It's the same root word as the word human. That when I can be myself as is, imperfect, and I'm goofing on me, about me, you know that I can be free of that stuff. See, I can tell you that I'm a lecher and self-centered and prideful and judgmental, and I can joke and goof on myself for being all that stuff because I have some relative freedom from that stuff. Not permanently. It's just like the obsession to drink. It's contingent on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. And I think it's a frightening and a high-risk proposition for any of us to think we're over something once and for all. Because every time I've ever... I went through a period where I had certain things I thought I was over, and they came back, and they came back in devious forms.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm that guy. I didn't take... After I did my... A little over 4 years sober, I did my first legitimate fourth and fifth step. I didn't do the six-step prayer. I said the seven-step prayer. Matter of fact, to be honest with you, I didn't even see the six-step prayer. I didn't understand the dynamics of it. I didn't understand what they meant by entirely ready. So what happens is I said the seven-step prayer, and I went about my life willfully determined to keep those defects of character at bay, and I'm going to conquer them. And I discovered, to my dismay, that there's a cause and effect in the universe, that for every action there's an opposite and equal reaction. In other words, whatever defect I willfully try to control gets stronger. And one of the first things that became very apparent to me, in my resentment list, it was so awful and so pathetic, I realized, oh my God, I'm such a judgmental guy. Well, that's, enough. I am not going to be judgmental again. And I became the guy who was very, very judgmental of people who were judgmental. And I was in charge of the judgment watch in AA. And I became the guy who was like that. I'm becoming exactly like them. Only I've dressed it up a little bit. Right? I put a thin spiritual veneer over it in a costume. But isn't the ego just still needing to grandize itself at the expense and imperfections of others? It was the same thing. I just dressed it up. And I... I started to hit some bottles with some of this stuff. And one of the things I realized is that I don't hold on to a defect without a reason. There's always some secret, maybe unrealized aspect of or illusion of benefit or value in the defect. And it's usually something I secretly think is going to protect me or gratify me or validate me or make me feel okay. One of the things that I had this thing about anger and rage. That I was, if God, what would happen to me if I really became entirely ready to God, for God to remove my anger? Then who's going to stand up for me and take care of me? What if you do something out of line? Who's going to protect me? Maybe God would have to. Do I trust God that much? See, isn't that the bottom line? I hold on to some of these defective defense mechanisms because the truth is I don't really trust God. Not really. I can talk like I do. But why am I still defending myself? And you cannot be defended and surrendered at the same time. They're mutually exclusive positions. That would be like in a war movie. A guy holding a white flag and a gun at the same time. I mean, you can't do that. You'll get killed. And that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to say, God, I've surrendered, and I got a knife behind my back holding it where nobody will see it. Just in case you pull anything, just in case God's busy making clouds and I have to defend myself. Right? And what happens is, what happens because of the nature of this malady of my spirit is that my management, my self-reliance fails me. And because it fails me, I hurt myself repeatedly and deeply, and the people I love and care about, and a lot of innocent people in my futile effort to defend myself and protect myself and gratify myself and ensure myself and support myself and self. And then you get it. I've had moments in sobriety after willful binges where I've had those moments where it's like the veil lifts and you see yourself where I just can't stand me. Thank God I haven't had one of those in quite some time. They're horrible. But luckily, I was entrenched in a program of Alcoholics Anonymous that can do something with those moments, which at the moment you're in it looks like it's terrible. They're really moments of tremendous growth. Tremendous growth. I don't know about you guys. I've never grown from my successes. I've had some years where I've made a lot of money. I mean, seven figures. I've had some years where I've been very successful. It hasn't moved me spiritually. If anything, it's probably pushed me backwards a little bit. But in the years where I'm going through a divorce, or in the years where I've done some things that how could I have done that? And how could I have been such a jerk? And why did I say that to those people? And those are the years those are the moments by which I grow. And isn't it funny that by nature I'm the kind of person that would run away from that? I'll run towards self and the things. There's something inherent in my nature that I will always gravitate to things that feel good and try to fix, medicate, or get away from anything that's uncomfortable. And oddly enough, in reality and in retrospect, everything that is uncomfortable is designed and by nature to make me more than what I was. And left unchecked with good sponsorship, without any good sponsorship, without Alcoholics Anonymous, every major intersection and turning point in my life where I was going to become more than what I was, I would have medicated myself right through that and never grown at all. I would have drank through it. or I would have done something. I've been very fortunate. I don't like pain. But sometimes you can run, but you can't hide. And I discovered that I hold on to this stuff because of this value. Chuck used to say, uncover, discover, discover the truth, Bob. This isn't working. This is a dead horse. Get, dismount the dead horse. Put, Bob, put the whip down. The horse is dead. Get off the dead horse. But you got any paddles? Bob, the horse is dead. But where's the paddles? Just dismount. Go on. I remember there was a TV show on TV. It's funny how you remember stuff. I was just a little kid. Anybody in here remember a TV show called Rescue 8? It was filmed at Universal. Matter of fact, the set's still at Universal Studios, the old original set in California. And it's part of the tour. And it was about these paramedics that worked out of a firehouse. And they would go out on these emergency calls when people were distressed. And this one particular episode was wonderful. These two guys come to this scene, and there's this little cute little girl, and she's hysterical, and she's in tears and scared to death, and her arm is wedged into a vending machine, and they can't get it out. She's stuck there, and she's really very, very scared and very upset. Now her parents have showed up, and her parents are hysterical. Get my daughter out. Oh, they're just going nuts. Well, the fire trucks are now pulling up. And they're pulling off torches and electric saws and stuff, which are making the little girl even more hysterical and more frightened, and the parents more insane. And the one paramedic's just standing there looking at all this. And everybody's pulling these equipment off, and everybody's hysterical and nuts. And he's very calmly standing there. And he finally kneels down next to the little girl, and he says, "Sweetheart, do you have something in your hand?" She goes, "Uh-huh. What do you got in your hand?" "A candy bar." "Sweetheart, let go of the candy." "It's my candy bar! It's my candy bar! It's my candy bar! But we can't get you out unless you let go. It's my candy bar!" She won't let go of that candy bar. She will not let go of that candy bar. And finally, after a while, he says to her, "Sweetheart, I will make you a promise. If you will let go of that candy bar, I will give you two candy bars of your choice." And she says, "Really?" And he says, "I promise." And because she trusts something some of us are in actuality unwilling to do, because she trusts, she lets go of the candy bar and her arm slides out of the vending machine. And she's free. What's your candy bar? You got one. You don't hold on to stuff for no reason. We're not self-destructive. We're too smart for that. We hang on to stuff because there's some delusion of value. What's delusion? It's psychotic wishful thinking. I know there's a goodie in here somewhere. And when you start to see the truth and uncover the truth, it's pretty easy. Once you start to see the truth and coupled, that seeing the truth in itself is not enough, I don't think. When you see the truth and trust God enough, you can let go of the candy bar. And what's the story of AA? How many times do you have to go to meetings? You hear the millions of stories of, "I finally let go, what I was trying to get just came to me." Mm-hmm. How many times do you hear the story? We're the people that when we let go of the candy bar, we get a whole box of candy. But not until you let go of the candy bar. Mm-hmm. Not until. In the seventh step prayer, it's a remarkable prayer. It says, "When ready, my Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me. All of me. Good and bad." God's going to make use of the bad as well as the good. Matter of fact, I think sometimes He makes more use of the bad. It's my defects and the struggles I've had and my failures. And the things about me that at one time I was very ashamed of that have become very, very useful to help God's kids. I've never helped anybody by my successes. Matter of fact, if you get too successful in AA, half of AA will resent you. But I've helped a lot of people by my failures and my struggles. So that God, here, I'm willing for you to have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. And for the first time in a whole series of prayers, starting on page 63, the word Amen. I'm asking God to not take away the things that I would even choose. Matter of fact, it doesn't even say in there, God, take away the things that I think you should take away. I don't even get a vote. Because what did I do in step 3? I gave up my will. I don't even have a way anymore. It's now for God to decide and remove the things that in His mind, in His vision, which is ultimately better than mine, that He gets stand in the way of my usefulness. And we all have stuff like that. Sometimes I'm a hostage to my own bad behavior. Isn't it funny, if you want to not drink, but you want to smoke marijuana, you'll have to find a sponsor that smokes marijuana. Mm-hmm. If you want to not drink and be sober but cheat on your wife, find a sponsor that cheats on your wife. Because he will be hostage to his own bad behavior. He'll never be able to bring it up with you. Right? If you smugly just need to take everybody's inventory and you love that ego gratification of gossiping and behind people's back and everything, find a sponsor that does that. If you want to feel smugly superior, like that you're like up here above everybody else in AA, gravitate to people that are up here. Right? But all of that stuff stands in the way of my usefulness. Because I can't be helpful to people. I become a hostage to my own self-serving behavior and stance and position. Some of these prejudices that I've had, I wouldn't have told you, because I don't think I would have known that I had some prejudices when I got sober. I had prejudice towards very successful, wealthy people. I always resented them. And then I got close to some in AA and my prejudice started to fall away. I had a thing I didn't even know I did. It was kind of a standoffishness. I like to fancy myself a very tolerant, liberal guy. But I was a little threatened, very subtly, just not enough to be crazy and homophobic, but a little bit by gay guys, just a little bit. And I didn't even know it was that way until I sponsored a couple of gay guys. And they turned my world around. I mean, they turned my world, my conscience, I got free of all that. I didn't even know that was in me until I found myself in a position where I'm sponsoring guys like that. And all these are all the things that diminish my usefulness. And it's in God's hands. It's not in mine. Because I would choose, if it was me, I would only choose the things that stood in the way of me being rich, famous, happy, and just better than everybody else. That's all. I mean, that's what I would choose. But God wants something better for me than what I want for me. He wants usefulness. I have known happiness. I'm telling you, it is fleeting. And happiness does not let you put your head in your pillow at night. A little burst of happiness makes you worry about when you're going to get some more. You can never get enough. But usefulness will take a guy like me that never felt very good about himself, a guy like me that is prone to depression and can't sleep well and is full of anxiety, and usefulness will let me lay my head on the pillow at night and feel very comfortable in my own life. Because when I'm useful, I'm doing exactly what I was crafted to do, and that's help God's kids. Every newcomer catches glimpses of this and doesn't know what he caught. I heard a new guy one time in a meeting said, he said the funny thing, it was so brilliant that he didn't know, he didn't hear himself. He didn't hear what he said. He said, I go over to the detox, and when I'm trying to talk to those people and help them, I feel really, really good. And then when I'm working on me, I feel really, really bad. Usefulness is better than happiness for a guy like me. It fills the vacancies. Isn't it odd that the way I always fantasized that it would feel like if I had acquired everything I needed to be happy, if I had all the right people, I mean the beautiful people, the smart people, loving me and understanding me the right way, I always imagined if I could put all of that in place, surely at that moment, I would feel complete and whole. And I have been close to painting all that and never have felt complete and whole. But I have felt that way when I reverse it. There have been moments in my sobriety, many moments, where I feel a rightness. I mean, a rightness about me and a rightness about you and a rightness about God's universe. And everything is perfect. And it's not from acquisition. It always comes from those moments when I've just listened to a fifth step or I've just spent 2 hours with some guy who's more dead than alive, coming off a drunk, and he's such a mess, and he's so pathetic, and he hates himself, and I love him. And you see, the vacancy always fills by moving it this way, never by bringing it this way. I always had it backwards. I always thought that I could fill it by addition, and it's never, the spirit is never healed by addition, it's always healed by subtraction. Take a break for dinner?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to take a 2-hour and 6-minute break. We'll be back here right at 7 o'clock to do...